Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Hi, it's Carol from BookReporter.com, and I'm here with our latest guest for our Book Reporter Talks To interview. This is Mary Beth Keene, and we're going to be talking about her book, Ask Again Yes. This is one of my favorite books of the year, not just of the summer. And I'm so delighted to have you here. This book works on so many levels. It's a Book Reporter Bets On selection because it's a family story, a love story, and a story about life's turns. Our reviewer noted that Keene has created something wholly unique with Ask Again Yes, a masterful book that will stay with anyone that reads it. And I agree. So let's start by you just telling us a little bit about Ask Again Yes.
It's difficult to summarize the plot in a book like this, but it's about two families who end up living as neighbors in a suburb of New York City, and the dads in both houses are police officers, and so they're sort of bonded by that, but they're not close friends. The kids, the boy in one house and the girl in another house, end up becoming quite close, and an event happens that divides the families, and you think they're never gonna, or they think they'll never see each other again. Of course they do. It's not a plot spoiler. You kind of sense that is coming, and the book is really about how the things that happen to us as kids continue to affect us when we're grown and how we have to deal with them and all the, you know, echoes of our childhood and how they keep on echoing for the rest of our lives.
Ah, interesting, because that is what happens. This is what goes on. You know, I've often felt that people get honest in their 30s and 40s, because in your 20s, everybody's got the best boyfriend, the best house, the best husband, the best kids. And then all of a sudden, things start kind of going awry, and life starts being messy. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of what you touch on in this book is the messiness of life, that it's always not perfect. Was that something that I'm on target with?
Yeah, you're totally on target. I think when you're 40, or the characters by the end of the book are in their 40s, I think you get a little bit shocked to realize that the thing that you're going to be is whoever you are now. You know, when you're in your 20s or earlier, of course, and even your 30s, you think you're still becoming, you know, I can still do this, I can still do that. And of course, you can still do a lot of things, but probably the job you have is the job you have, or the career you have. The person you're with is probably the person you're with, and so on. You know, and I think to some people, that comes as a little bit of a shock, I guess, you know, and that's where we get midlife crises from.
Right.
But this, I think this book is a little bit about that too. The things that we can get away with when we're younger, we suddenly can't get away with anymore, you know, as we get into our 40s and 50s and certainly older. So yeah, that's certainly what the book was about.
Yeah, and bad behavior gets noted a lot differently. Bad behavior is not just bad kid behavior. It has bigger impacts on other people at the same time as well. The smaller sphere, the younger you are.
Exactly.
And then and how you're influencing your kids. Well, character is clearly something that you love writing.
Yes.
And it defines so much in the book. Do you always start with character?
Always. I always start with character. And I think I try not to ever start anything, whether it's, I don't know that I'm starting a novel when I start a novel, but if I am writing any sort of fiction, I like to see a character in motion. You know, first I think about who that character is, and then I put him or her, you know, in a situation. And that's how I like to begin, because then you can learn about that character and they can surprise you. I mean, I'm not one of those authors who thinks the character is in control of everything, but you do have twists and turns when you put them in motion that you might not be able to see if you're just thinking about, you know, personality traits and things like that.
That's just it. What was the first character that you had? What came to mind?
Francis was first.
Really? Okay.
Peter was a close second, and I knew that they were not father and son.
Okay, so Francis is the one, he's the older cop.
Yes.
He's one of the fathers.
Yes,
right?
He's one of the fathers, and Peter is the boy who grows up in the house next door. And I knew that their lives would intersect in some way, but I didn't know how or for how long. But I saw them very clearly early on, but separately. And it took me a long time to figure out how, you know, their lives would keep crossing, I suppose, and how they mattered to each other.
Yeah. So Francis plays by the rules. He plays by the book. He's a cop. This is the way you do things. Everything is correct. And he runs his home basically the same way as well. This is the way you operate. Whereas Peter has grown up in a house with his father, Brian, who is a cop, but doesn't play quite the same way.
Right.
And did you set that conflict up right from the beginning of those two different people, two different players?
Kind of. I mean, I thought of Francis as being a very good cop. You know, he joined like a lot of young people do, without fully thinking out what this life would be like. But I think he took it very seriously. He came at it honestly, and he tried to be a good cop. Brian, I thought of as maybe a little bit different, but I thought of Peter as being more like Francis, ultimately. And he comes out of a house that is chaotic, but the way he copes with that is by being ordered sort of within himself. Mm-hmm. He's a good boy. And I saw him that way from the beginning. I think a lot of kids who grow up in a house like he did lash out, you know, they do all sorts of crazy things and they sort of have an excuse, you know, if their parents are the way that Peter's are. But I found it more moving that he was such a rule follower without anyone telling him to follow the rules. He just didn't know what else to do.
Right. And actually he was creating order in a very unorderly house.
Exactly.
Because his dad wasn't completely playing by the rules and his mom was definitely dealing with mental illness.
Right.
You don't quite know what she has, but you're seeing these terrible strains. And it's interesting because we don't talk about mental illness enough now.
Right.
But we really didn't talk about it in 1973.
Right.
You know, it was just not talked about at all.
I mean, even in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. And I tried to kind of mirror the vocabulary that people had then, mm-hmm. you know, and their understanding of it. And really, I read a lot of memoirs. I talked to several psychologists and psychiatrists. And it has come a long way, but there's still a very long way to go.
Mm-hmm. Because it's still there's still a stigma attached. There's still, that's not perfect. Because I think we're still going back to in your 20s and 30s, everything's supposed to be perfect.
Right.
And if it's not, you failed. You failed. And I think that's a huge stigma that's still attached.
And I think today, a lot of people have said, there's this one particular scene where Anne, who is suffering, is in public and people say, we wouldn't react that way now to the way she behaves, that deli counter scene.
Yes.
And I'm not so sure that they're right about that. I think people still, your first instinct is to step back and just get away from a person like that. And I don't know if it comes to people's minds right away that someone's ill, you know, someone needs help. So I think, you know, a lot has changed, but like I said,
The same thing because after I read the book, a woman came up to me in the supermarket and just started talking to me. She was she was older, she was clearly dealing with some form of dementia. And I'd seen her having these very active conversations with other people throughout the store, but I thought she knew them. And then she came up and started talking to me, and I was so conflicted because I wanted to not be rude, but by the same token, I was trying to figure out in the back of my head, who is this woman here with? How did she get here? And does anybody know she's here? Was like my first instincts. So when you see somebody like that, it's this back away kind of thing, but in the back of your head, you're getting in your car to leave, especially in the 70s, and saying, oh, well, that wasn't me.
Yeah.
That wasn't us.
Right.
You know?
Stay away from that person. Stay away from that family.
Yeah. And the one thing is, I was thinking about if these two families did not live next door to each other in close proximity, and we should probably set up that the husbands both worked in the Bronx, mm-hmm. am I correct, on the beat, and they didn't want to raise their families in the neighborhood where they would be, so they moved out to Long Island.
To Rockland.
Rockland. Rockland, mm-hmm. I see I'm not good on my...
It's okay. No, I've seen that in a lot of places. It's Rockland.
They moved out to Rockland. Go change
I've seen
that.
Westchester too, but it's
Interesting.
Rockland.
Interesting. Yeah. Rockland County. Okay. So they moved their families out to Rockland County, and in doing that, they lived next door to each other.
Right.
If they were not next door to each other, like you sometimes don't know what's happening with the people down the block. Right. Did that have a big bearing on they had to be next door to each other?
Kind of. I saw the kids kind of going back and forth in the yards. Mm-hmm. And the way that you become friends with another kid your age at such a young age is just proximity.
Right.
So I think I thought a lot about my own childhood. Gillum is set in a fictional Pearl River, which is in Rockland. That's where I grew up, and that's actually where I live again. And the 80s were very much like that. You know, there was just a big pile of bikes, mm-hmm. you know, on somebody's lawn, and the kids just went back and forth in and out of houses. I remember being like in the tub at the end of the day, and there might be like a neighbor or two in there, you know, I was 4 or 5 years old. Then they'd, you know, somebody'd get sent home. Dinner was sort of like a free-for-all. If somebody was having burgers, you'd end up, you know, having a few extra kids. So I thought of it like that, except there was this one family the Stanhopes at the center who were just not getting in line with that,
right,
you know, who
right.
just wanted out, who were loners, who were isolated, just wouldn't participate in that way, even though the child in the house did want to, mm-hmm. you know, and I imagined him sort of looking out the window at all the fun everybody else was having.
Yeah, it's like know, everybody's going to the ice cream guy, he's not going.
Exactly.
Everybody's going to these places, I'm not part of that group.
Right.
But having them be right next door to each other, because sometimes people can be a little bit further down the block, and you know their secrets, but you're not living them over the fence line like quite the same way.
Right.
But I agree, but childhood growing up was completely different. I mean, now I would say that the kids on one side may not know the kids on the other side, like we're in the middle, and it's just not the same,
totally.
The same setup
well, kids
anymore.
Kids are so scheduled now, too. You know, they've got like baseball followed by soccer, followed by homework, followed by whatever.
Right.
So there's not a lot of free play.
No, no, no. And there's not just, and it's also not the chance to sort of get into those conflicts and resolve them with people that you live in close proximity to, which is what these kids were doing all the time.
Yeah.
And then also you have that they fell in love because they were became attracted to each other.
Yeah.
I mean, in eighth grade, I don't know if you're quite like in love, but you're there.
Crushing.
You're crushing each other.
Yeah.
So because they were, we always, you know, often hear about the kids are in, the kids are friends and the parents are in conflict. Mm-hmm. And it creates a whole new set of tension, which in this book really starts to ramp up as well.
Yeah.
Was that something that you knew where you're writing going in, or it's like?
Yeah. I mean, I knew that, well, it's hard to talk around plot spoilers.
Yeah, we don't do that.
I knew that the families would be against an eventual relationship between these two for a variety of reasons. And so I couldn't really have them get along that well, you know.
Right.
And it, you know, I didn't want out and out fighting, but in that way that, you know, people are just not interested in other, you know, they're just not having it. I wanted it to be more like that.
Mm-hmm.
It ends up being a little stronger than that, but I knew that they would be sort of star-crossed in that way.
Right.
Sometimes I think of this book as like a Romeo and Juliet, except if they had stayed together, you know, if they'd lived.
Right.
And then they had to cope with the parents who didn't
get along.
And then they had to cope with each other,
mm-hmm.
you know, after you've already, you know, won your man or won your lady, and then you have to live with them and what that's like. So I did know that there'd be conflict in that way.
And later on, you can't sit there and say there's something wrong with him because your mother would be like, you told you so.
Exactly.
I knew that was going to happen.
Exactly.
So you have this whole thing where you would normally be able to talk to people about things and you just can't do it quite the same way.
Well, they're not talkers anyway, these crew.
This crew is very insular of like what's going on. You've been with your husband since you were teenagers,
right?
Would that, what you were going through influence when you were writing this book with your friends and going back to, I take it you didn't live in Pearl River all the time.
I did live in Pearl River. He lived in the town next door. So we actually met in high school. I went to an all-girls school and he went to our brother's school. But he has a long family estrangement in his family.
Mm.
And that was part of what started me down this road on this book. Because our kids started to ask us some questions about that. And I started thinking about how estrangement works. And so many families have a child or a parent or someone who's estranged from the central group. And I just kept noticing that no one thinks that it's gonna last as long as it lasts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think, I'm having an argument with someone that's gone on for 6 months, a year, 2 years. Next thing, 20 years go by and you're at a wake, you know, or a funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a shock. You know, life is going by more quickly now, I think, as, you know, you get older. And thinking about all of that is really what started me on this.
Yeah,
on
the
this
turns
book.
Are happening quicker. Everything's happening quicker. And you're realizing it's really short. You think it's this really, really long run, and it's not as long as you think it's going to be. But where are these conflicts? And they're still rearing their heads.
And you're still family, even if you're not speaking to one another. You
right.
know, you're still oriented around each other, even if there's silence. You know, in cases where I won't go to this party because so-and-so is going to be there, you're still making decisions based on that person.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought a lot about, especially between a parent and a child, how much do we matter to each other even if we haven't spoken to each other in a long time, you know, and how much are we still influencing each other, you know, things like that.
And look at Peter with his mother, because he's constantly trying to go see his mother. He's trying to make that bond, like, all the time. Even if it's being pushed away, he's realizing that's something he needs.
Right.
And he's not able to have it the way he wants it.
Right.
You know? So it's, as a result, he's looking for things in different places.
Exactly.
But it puts a huge burden on who ends up to be his wife, Kate. I mean, it puts a huge burden on her because he has unresolved issues that she's trying to then take over and deal with.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you do a lot of looking into mental illness, like so that you could basically describe that this is what the mother was going through?
You know, I was, of all the aspects of this book, that was the one I was most nervous about, I think, because people feel really protective of their own stories, I think. If you have a person in your life who's been diagnosed with, say, bipolar disorder, I think sometimes if a person reads a character who's not exactly like the person in their own lives, they get really upset. Mm-hmm. So I started by reading a lot of memoirs. I also spoke to several doctors and talked about what sort of symptoms would lead to what. But the thing is, everything is so loose. You know, it's two different, 10 people could be diagnosed with the same thing and it would look different in all 10 people. Exactly. And so that was both a blessing and a curse in a way, because I was afraid people would say, well, you know, my dad had this and that's not how it manifested itself, but it did in someone else. So I was careful about that. But on the other hand, you can't be too careful because then the writing dies. But I was scared through the first and second draft to even enter Anne's point of view. And so I sort of wrote around her.
Right.
But then once I realized that I wanted to create empathy for her, because I was really starting to feel how much she missed out on in her own. She was destructive and she was toxic in a lot of ways, but she really robbed herself of the most things. I realized I had to enter her point of view and I just had to like go for it and see how it, you know, turned out. And one of the first scenes I wrote was that deli scene.
Ah, interesting.
And I think I kept coming back to, a lot of the memoirs mentioned fear being a big trigger. And to think of someone who is acting out like that, being really in their hearts afraid, I found really moving, you know, and I kept going back to that.
Yeah, because that's not an emotion that you're thinking. You're thinking of power. You're thinking this person has power, not really that she really doesn't. Yeah. And that's the reason she's reacting. I felt that those pieces were very, very authentic. Because though I think there's shades of mental illness. I think there's shades. And the one that you hit on completely worked. I didn't feel like it was forced or contrived or anything like that.
Yeah,
no. I really, you know, I felt that, you know, completely. How about addiction, which is a strong part of the story as well, both alcohol addiction and what happens with that. Did you do a lot of research into that, or is it playing out things you know way too well?
Yeah, I think I didn't have to do all that much research. I mean, I think I hate to reinforce stereotypes. I'm an Irish person, so I both of my parents are from Ireland, so I don't know if this is only an Irish thing. I don't think it is, but I do know a lot of people who struggle, you know, in this way. And we were talking about getting older before, and for some reason, once you hit your mid-40s, I think there are people who kind of clean it up and go on and sort of cut way back and get on with their lives, and they just can't do the things that they did when they were kids. And some people can't. They can't rein it in. Mm-hmm. And I'm noticing it's like, you know, two paths diverge in a wood, and some people are going on one and some people are going on another. I thought a lot about, you know, my own drinking history. I think I had my first drink, I think I was 12 or 13, and so did most of my friends. Mm-hmm. But I know that I don't have a problem. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why. You know, I don't know how that happened. I did some serious, you know, drinking in my youth and more recently. But I think, you know, I don't know why it turns out that way for me. And for some people, it doesn't seem fair exactly. Mm-hmm. But I've seen with, you know, lots of people or even friends of friends of friends, they just cannot stop.
And they start early in the day and they don't even realize that it's starting and it's going. Now with recycling, you can see there's a lot more bottles when you go into past people's recycling because I mean, you're not snooping, but if you're walking in the neighborhood, you can definitely
walk
sit there
the
and
dog,
see what's going on. You know, and
a lot of Jameson's in there.
If we have a big party, I sit there and go, whoa, what are they going to think about it? Like the guys from recycling are going to care what we've been drinking and stuff like that. But there is this more public way of seeing that. Whereas I think that also, I mean, we used to go to bars when we were young. Mm-hmm. Like, we could go out when we were 18 and drink, which was, in some ways, I wish that was the wall right now because kids don't know how to drink these days either. They think that drinking the entire bottle of vodka is like the way you're supposed to go out and drink. Whereas when we went out, they were watering down the drinks because they knew you were drunk.
Right.
You know, and it doesn't happen like that.
You were always too broke, I think, to drink in bars.
Right, that's true.
Because it was like, you know, if you're in Manhattan at, age 19.
Oh, that's way too expensive.
Yeah, it was, no, it was all, there was no money left.
So I was at Fordham in the Bronx, it was still cheap.
Oh, okay. Right. Pearl River was cheap too.
But. Yeah. Yeah, but they watered down the drinks. I mean, let's
face
it.
Exactly. That's actually a good point. I didn't think about that.
Yeah. And as the night went on, they were getting more and more water being put in. I also remember, too, that if somebody left and they were like in a bar fight or something like that and they headed up the block to the other bar, they just call and say they were on the way. And that, like, so-and-so's on their way up the street. We just threw them out.
Oh.
Like, don't let them in,
funny.
You know, which is really funny. Huh. But you see that there are also patterns that have to do with drinking of obsessive, like, you know, obsessive, that you can't stop certain things. And a lot of people, this could be something that's more quiet because it's just drinking.
Right.
It's not, you know, it's not something, it's not gambling. It's not something
people
want to see as much.
I think sometimes people think of alcoholics as being out and loud and at the bars and falling off their stools and have to be, but a lot of it happens at home, you know, in private. I know a lot of people who don't like to drink in a group, you know, or out, they don't like to lose control of themselves in public, but privately in their own homes, you know, that's when it happens. And I don't think a lot of people realize that.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's the weirdest.
Yeah, quiet drinking.
Yeah, that's the weirdest of all. You know, social, I sort of understand, but this I don't get at all.
Very, very different. So how about life as a cop? Because they've got their own language. They've got their own way of doing things. Did you interview cops or do you have cops in your family?
I don't have any in my family, which I guess is unusual for an Irish family, but I did grow up around a lot of NYPD and local Orangetown and Clarkstown PD. And the dads of a lot of my friends growing up were police officers. So I was able to talk to both generations. So a lot of the dads of friends my age would have been on the force in the 70s. And so I asked them a lot of questions, and then I know a lot of others, you know, through the years, through the generations, and then down to active duty now. Some people didn't want to be mentioned in the acknowledgments. Some people were tickled to be mentioned, and that was fine. But it was interesting. I think the police department is different now than it was then, but they certainly have their own language. It took a long time. I think every cop wants to tell a story about the craziest call they ever had, but I was more interested in how they felt, you know, and that took a little while. And they'd be like, what do you mean? How did I feel? What are you talking about? No, you know, right away. But, you know, eventually they'd start, you know, saying different times that they might have felt a little bit afraid or they might have not wanted to do things by the book. And that's where things got interesting to me. Yeah.
They always say they're on the job.
Yeah,
you're on the job.
Yeah.
On the job. It's like you're not going to work. I'm going on the job.
I actually just got reprimanded by someone at a reading in I was either in Rhode Island or Connecticut, who said I shouldn't say cop. I know that it is sort of pejorative.
Right.
But everyone, I'm going to use the word that the people use, and at least in my town, if someone gets into the police academy, they say he's on the cops. Now, you know, it's just a manner of speaking. So I guess I would just want to acknowledge, I do know the difference between cops and police officer, you know, and I guess I've realized that I've not been differentiating when I talk about it.
No, but it's also, I think that when we grew up, there were cops. It was like, wasn't the police officers, it wasn't whatever. It was you using the vernacular. Vernacular
sergeant,
that was so
detective.
Much of the time.
Yeah.
No. You didn't know that. You just knew it's somebody on the beat. On the beat, on the force.
Right.
Those were the things that you were thinking about. But it was not pejorative at all. It was more like you had a lot of respect for the people at that, you know, at that time.
That's
in your life.
That's how I feel, but I guess people see it differently.
Yeah, interesting. Really, really interesting. So readers think a lot about writing, but they don't think about rewriting.
Yeah,
okay?
I bet. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't think about that. And this book had a lot of changes along the way. In fact, I was really interested to learn that you originally wrote it from Kate's point of view.
Yeah.
And it was in first person.
Yes.
And where do you just realize you're painting yourself into a hole, or what happened?
Yes, I mean, basically that's what happened. So that's happened three times now. This is my third novel. I've started each one in the first person, gotten to around page 120, and then realized I can't. And then I start over again. So I'm starting to think this is just what I do. But there is something about the first person I really love. You just can't get close enough. I guess this is sort of a craft issue, but third person, I think you can get much closer to a character's interior than in first person because you can know things that they don't know about themselves.
Right, right.
And, you know, as much as we say the things that we want or feel and then we think things, I think there's that third level of what we really, really feel. And in first person, it's really hard to access that, I think. And so the camera can be much, much closer in third. And I think each time I just knew that I wanted to get there eventually. I also think first person, you need sort of like a jazz hands personality in the character.
So it's
you have to be sort of riveting enough in the first person to hold the reader's attention through 400 pages, maybe. Mm-hmm. And all of these people, part of the point of the book is that they're pretty average. You know, they're you, they're me, they're everybody. And I think I needed to find their quirks sort of outside. I don't think they could identify them. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But
because you were seeing it from the outside. You were saying, oh, she's not doing that right. Maybe coming from her mother's point of view.
Right.
Maybe coming from some other family member's point of view. Because if not, it would be like, oh, this is like perfect. But you'd right. have to have the reader would be the only one sharing that kind of, it's not right.
And I wanted the reader to be able to draw conclusions on his or her own. And so when you see the contradictions in the way people see things, mm-hmm. then the reader is also there coming to his or her own conclusions. And I think that's what, you know, sort of pulls a person into a book. Mm-hmm. So in any case, I switched it.
There's this one really big night that we don't want to give any spoilers away if something happens. Mm-hmm. And did you always know there was going to be this cataclysmic moment or where it was going to be? Or did you play around with that as you were writing?
I knew there was going to be a moment. I didn't know what it was going to be or how it was going to unfold. And I also knew that one of the cops involved in the story was going to make an error in judgment, mm-hmm. either large or small. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that every single police officer I spoke to had a regret about doing the wrong thing, you know, even if it was in the 70s, maybe showing up at an address and saying, ah, it's all fine, you know, and then something happens 2 days later. You know, they really carry that with them for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to access, you know, something like that, but I didn't know what shape it would take.
Where you go and where you go from there.
Yeah.
So what made you choose to start the book, open the book in 1973?
You know, I didn't start the book originally in 1973. I kept doing this sort of round structure where we begin at the end and then circle back. It just wasn't working. So ultimately, it doesn't sound very revolutionary, but I decided to just structure it chronologically. But early readers of the book, if you don't have the whole book in front of you, I think it's hard to see why 1973 matters mm-hmm. as much as it ultimately ends up mattering. But it was such a rich, evocative time in New York City's history, especially in, you know, the history of police work, that I just wanted to capture that, I think, and sort of give it the reader a snapshot of what things were like then.
Well, and also before that, people did live in the neighborhood where they were the cop, when they were a police officer when they were growing up. And now it was, I really want to be removed from there. I don't want to live in the same neighborhood. Whereas before it was, he's on the beat, we know him.
Right.
It's very, very different. I think that was the time that happened.
They changed the law. Well, you had to live in New York City, I think up until, I'd have to fact check this, but probably around 1970. And as soon as that law opened, you were then allowed to live in Rockland, Westchester, Long Island, maybe somewhere else. Then everybody started moving out. Yeah.
Interesting. Had you always planned that you set everything over decades? Was it interesting doing that? Or I know you had no plan from the beginning.
I know that there are really people who have these like intricate plans and they stick to them, and I would love to be that person.
Right.
But I just don't. No, it just felt like you needed, if I only told the 2017 version of the events and we just saw, you know, these two people as grown-ups, I don't think a reader would feel the impact of what they're really going through unless you have the entire history.
So you were right there, right from the beginning.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And you would feel I hope a reader at the end can sort of see Peter the kid inside Peter the adult, Kate the kid inside Kate the adult. And without that, I don't know that this would be, you know, any different than a lot of stories. I think that history makes it a little bit different. But I would love to write a book that takes place over like 3 days, first person, present tense, you know, and I'm sure I'll try it and then it'll end up in the garbage and I'll end up back in the third person. Yeah.
But maybe start in the third person, but the first person I think gets you to understand. I agree though, because if you only got them today, they would be telling it through their lens.
Right.
Whereas this way, you were seeing everybody's lens back there to understand how they got. And I think that was, to be honest, I think that's what makes this book so interesting and so different because that, you know, that's what's happened along the way.
I really hate flashback too. As a reader, I just don't, I mean, of course, every novel needs a little bit of flashback, but I don't like living there for too long. You know, if I start reading too much flashback, I wonder why the scene wasn't just set back in wherever we were sent.
Right.
So that's what kept happening too. If I started in any other place than where I ended up having to pull anyway, mm-hmm. you know, from back there. And once you're back for 3-4 pages, I'm like, well, why don't I go on back there and set the whole thing section or scene or chapter there,
right,
and then be more hands-off. Because I think sometimes flashback feels a little directive, too, mm-hmm, to a reader. So
yeah, because you're explaining, this is what happened. Oh, let's go back and see how this unfolded.
And why this is important.
But you're only seeing it from one point of view then. Because you're seeing it from, because you're not having flashback from each of the characters, or that's not going to work at that point as well.
Right, exactly.
So how did you know you were done? Like, I mean, you've tried it all these different ways. Did you just go, I got it?
I know, it sounds very hippy-dippy, but I kind of like feel it in my bones.
Mm-hmm.
You, like, feel it in your body that it's like, it's just, I get like this like queasy feeling when I was doing it any other way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, is it good? Yeah, it's good. And I'd go for, and I was trying to convince myself.
Right.
And then when I really knew it, I was sort of on track, you know, something feels like settled and I mm-hmm. just felt excited.
Mm-hmm.
And then the end, I don't think I've ever had an experience where I wrote an end and stopped typing. And I thought, oh, that's it. That's the end. That happened today. Like, I didn't see that coming. You know, that was a weird one.
I just said, okay, I got their story down.
Yeah, that's it.
Got their story down. Now, there are a number of authors that you mentioned in your acknowledgments.
Mm-hmm.
Do you share your writing with them along the way?
Yes. I don't know if you're referring to anyone in particular, but pretty much any author I mentioned, we swap work. I went to UVA for my MFA, and a lot of people have, you know, different things about to say about MFAs, but I only had a great experience, mm-hmm. and one of the best things is that a lot of us still exchange work, and we don't live near each other,
mm-hmm.
we barely see each other, but I think because our whole relationship and friendships were built on criticizing each other,
mm-hmm.
you know, it doesn't feel like taking a bullet, you know, when they say what's not working or what is working. And I think I genuinely feel like we all want each other to do well.
We want success for each
other.
Yeah,
and it's not a zero-sum game. You know, we can mm-hmm. all write good books, and I think we're all just trying to help each other out, because if you don't have readers, I don't know how people do this
mm-hmm.
without someone to say, like, this has gone way off the rails, or I don't care about this person, or what? So I use all of the readers I mention at different parts. Yeah.
Well, and it's also interesting too, because the agent has a role in it and the editor has a role, but sometimes other writers, I think, can get you moved on a different path, or they can just flag something. I'm known for being way too blunt, because people hand me a manuscript and I'll just say, I think there's a gap here, I don't think I really need it.
Yeah.
But,
oh, I would love that.
Yeah.
You'll be my next reader. You're on the list.
I love doing that.
I mean, blunt is great.
We made films when I was at the magazine before I did this. And a lot of times we'd be editing and they'd say, well, this is missing. And there was one shoot I didn't go on, I was pregnant and I decided not to go. And they kept saying, oh, well, I think this is really missing. And I said, do you understand? It's there. Like, it's there. You don't need any more of the footage. You don't need anything. You're seeing all the footage that was left behind. And I think that happens for writers as well. You know what was in your head that didn't make it to the paper, or what you already threw out. Whereas somebody else is just sitting there reading and going, it works. Or they're saying, there's a gap.
Right.
There's something here, and I'm not getting there. I'm not walking that walk fast
enough. Or I'm
not
understanding someone's motivation.
Right.
Yeah. If you know a person really, really well, you know why they're doing the things they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it takes someone else to say, I'm not following, A is not following B here.
Right. I'm not seeing why they picked up the bottle. I'm not seeing
why
he did what he was doing.
Or why she's so mad about this, or why he's upset about that.
Right.
And then you realize you're missing some connective tissue, I guess.
It was in your head, but it didn't make it to the paper.
Right.
And a lot of times when we were editing, I'd say, you know, move this, move this, move this. And I think we've got the story.
Yeah.
But you're throwing out so much, and sometimes you don't realize just getting rid of it is like fine.
Right.
It really works.
Yeah.
And this book was very fast paced. I mean, I sat down and read it very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I always hesitate to say that for writers who spend a long time on the book.
It's funny.
But I read it, and I think it was because when I sat down, I completely connected with the material.
That's
I was
good.
Like, it was, you know, moving
it does
me
feel
on.
A little when you cook like a 8 hour, you know, chop a lot of things, like
Thanksgiving,
big meal, and then everyone eats it in 20 minutes.
Right.
You know, it does feel a little bit like that, but it means it's good. Yeah. So it's fine.
But it completely flowed, and the meal is one I remembered.
Oh, good.
So just like, you know, with the book, it's like, and it's interesting because I think I read this before we met in January. We met at Watcher Institute.
Yeah.
I read it before then. But this story is still very fresh with me, considering how much I've read.
Oh, funny.
And that's something to be said, because a lot of times I don't remember the characters. I don't remember things that unfolded and what happened. And when I was sitting down to do this, I didn't reread the book. I was remembering things that had come up. And because I think you wrote with great clarity about your characters and about their situations. And there's something to be said about that.
Oh, good. Well,
yeah, so that was like really good. So you wrote two previous novels. So there wasn't really anything different about this one. You went into the same different little
same problems, same bad habits. Yeah, mm-hmm. And people keep describing this as a departure. I don't really see it that way. You know, I still approach character the same way. And
do you think it's because it's not as historical as Fever was? And it, they both were historical.
Well, The Walking People is described as historical,
right.
But it starts in the 50s, 60s, ends up in the present. And it's sort of, my parents immigrated from Ireland around that time. So I didn't really have to research. I mean, a little bit, but I don't think of it as being historical like Fever was. So that's like sort of, this is contemporary, but it doesn't start that much after The Walking People did. Right. I don't know why, I don't know.
It was funny because Kristen Hannah's The Great Alone was nominated for Goodreads as a historical fiction, and she got in touch and said, Carol, I never realized the 70s were historical fiction. But when you think about it, it's how many years ago
now?
It's, 50
But no one is describing this as historical fiction, which is fine with me.
Fine with you. No, because I think it moves so fast. But if you didn't understand the 70s and have you explain what everybody was going on, I think that the clarity is there to pull on where people end up later on.
Right.
And I think that's like really important.
I hope so.
So what are you working on now? Or starting?
It's in a very early stage. Yeah, I'm starting a new novel, but it's way too soon.
It's in the first person still.
Yeah, still in the first person. I still haven't thrown out 100 pages and banged my head against the wall. So that's all coming.
Right.
I'm saying that's probably around November that'll happen.
Okay, yeah. So we can just call it. We'll pull that up on the calendar. When you're writing, you've set times during the day.
Yeah.
Take an idea like at night. Like, do you just stop and go and write, or
no.
Do you just hold it for the next day?
I might take a note. I have those little moleskin books around the house.
Yeah.
I'll take a note if it's a really good thought, but I'll wait until the next morning.
And see if it's okay.
It's too crazy in my house. It's nuts. Like, when the kids come home from school and then my husband comes home and my parents live next door and the phone is ringing, it's just, and I'm done. If I've written several hours already in that day, I don't think it's any good. At night, I try to read a lot if I can. And catch up on stuff like that. And then reading at night, I think, helps me the next day.
Fuels you to go back to the next day. Do you stop in the middle of a paragraph or something like that? Or you stop where you stop?
Anything. If it's not going well, I will stop to read and just make maybe 2 or 3 days reading days to kind of like hit the reset button. But I'll stop. I usually have a 1,000-word goal per day. Sometimes I don't make it, but then you have to make up for it, the next day. There's always the rules. Like, sometimes I say I can't have a cup of tea unless I've written 400 words, then I can make a cup of tea and come back.
You bribe yourself.
Things like that. Yeah. But I'll stop wherever it feels right to stop that day. And every day is different.
Do you always go back, do you rewrite, or do you just keep going writing?
I will reread what I wrote the day before, and I usually end up cutting like 300 or 400 words, sometimes more. Sometimes I'll cut the whole thing, all 1,000 words. Which sucks.
Yeah.
But I'll do that. I try not to go back too far because then you're spending your whole time reading. But it depends on where I am in the book. You know, the first third of a book takes so much longer to write than the second third and certainly the third third. So it depends on where I'm at and if I'm still trying to figure out what's happening.
Well, for all that she's described, for the pain that we're going back in the book, it's a fabulous book. I highly recommend it. It is really one of my favorite books of 2019. And I read at the beginning of the year, and I said right away, I know this is going to be one that I'm going to want to recommend to people, and I really want them to read. And I think this would be great for book clubs to discuss, because there's so much in there about personal relationships, familial relationships, and you're right, the breakdowns that happen along the way, and what you do have to deal with. So I thank you so much for joining
us today.
Thank
you for having me. This was fun.
If you're interested in listening to an excerpt from Ask Again Yes by Mary Beth Keane, read by Molly Pope, keep listening, as that is coming up after the credits. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Book Reporter Talks To. You can read more about the author and the books discussed in this episode in our show notes, which can be found on our website, bookreporter.com. There are 3 ways you can support this podcast. First, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Second, share it or tell a friend about it. And third, rate or review us, as that will help people discover us. This episode is brought to you by the Book Report Network, with thanks to our audio and session producer, Amanda Book. And now, an excerpt from Ask Again Yes.
Gillum was nice enough, but lonely, Lena Teobaldo thought when she first saw it. It was the kind of place that if she were there on vacation, she'd love for the first 2 days, and then by the third day, she'd start looking forward to leaving. It didn't seem quite real. The apple trees and maples, The shingled houses with front porches, the cornfields, the dairy, the kids playing stickball in the street as if they didn't notice their houses were sitting on a half acre of grass. Later, she'd figure out that the kids played the games their parents had played growing up in the city. Stickball, hopscotch, kick the can. When a father taught a son how to throw a ball, he marched that boy to the middle of the road as if they were on a block tight with tenements, because that's where he'd learned from his father. She'd agreed to the trip because it was something to do, and if she'd stayed in Bay Ridge that Saturday, her mother would have made her bring food to Mrs. Vinard, who'd never been right since her boy went missing in Vietnam. Her cousin Carolina's dress was hanging on the hook behind Lena's bedroom door, altered and ready for Lena to wear in just 6 days' time. She'd gotten her shoes, her veil. There was nothing more to do other than wait. So when Frances asked if she wanted to take a little trip to check out a town he'd heard about through a guy at work, she'd said sure. It was a beautiful fall day. It would be nice to get out to the country for a few hours. She'd pack a picnic lunch. They unpacked that lunch on a bench outside the public library, and in the time it took to unwrap their sandwiches, eat them, sip all the tea from the thermos, only one person entered the library. A northbound train pulled into the station, and three people got off. Across the town square was a deli, and next to it, a five and dime with a stroller parked outside. Frances had driven them in Lena's father's Datsun, her brother Carol's copy of Led Zeppelin IV stuck in the tape deck. Lena didn't have a driver's license, didn't have the first idea how to drive. She'd assumed she'd never have to learn. "So, what do you think?" Frances asked later as they eased back onto the Palisades Parkway. Lena opened the window and lit a cigarette. "Pretty," she said. "Quiet." She slipped off her shoes and put her feet up on the dashboard. She'd put in for 2 weeks of vacation time, a week before her wedding, plus a week after. And that day, a Saturday, was her first day of the longest stretch of days she'd had off in 3 years. "You saw the train? There's also a bus that goes to Midtown," he said. She thought it a random piece of information until it hit her like a kick in the shin that he wanted to live there. He hadn't said that. He'd said only that he wanted to take a spin in the car, check out a place he'd heard of. She thought he only wanted a break from all the wedding talk. Relatives from Italy and Poland were already arriving, and her parents' apartment was packed with food and people every hour of the day. No one from Ireland was coming, but some relation of Francis's who'd emigrated to Chicago had sent a piece of Irish china. Francis said he didn't mind. It was the bride's day anyway. But now she saw he had a plan in mind. It seemed so far-fetched, she decided not to mention it again unless he brought it up first.